This hour, stories of some of the most precious gifts that can be given or received. These are not the kinds of gifts that can be wrapped in pretty paper and presented on a holiday. We're talking about acts of kindness. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. An act of kindness may put a smile on your face, warm your heart, or it could change your life.
She made sure that I had a place, a safe place to sleep that night. Even when I got my first apartment, she came and she brought some blankets and things because I had no furniture, you know.
Today, true stories of acts of kindness from Latasha Deloach of Iowa City, Jill Preetz of Ames, Angie Hansen of Mason City, and others. Join the conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. With our 24-hour news cycle, it's easy to get caught up in the crisis of the day. But while all of that is going on, individuals everywhere are making a difference by performing acts that will never make it into a newscast. This hour, we're going to take some time out to focus on acts of kindness. We'll find out about a cross-cultural, cross-species exchange that saved a life. We'll hear stories of friends and neighbors pulling together to help families during times of need. But first, Latasha Deloach is a social worker in Johnson County. She is also a newly elected member of the Iowa City School Board, and she says she couldn't have gotten to where she is today without the support of a very special woman. Latasha, thank you so much for being here.
Yes, thank you for allowing me to share my story.
Absolutely. So you connected with a school guidance counselor. Tell me about her.
So I moved from, actually I moved from Dubuque to Iowa City my sophomore year of high school at Tennant City High, and I met my guidance counselor. I was assigned to her by letter when I was an M, and her name is Pat Dustin, and I met her, and she always tells the story of me coming into her office and saying, you need to help me because I'm going to be someone important and I'm planning on being successful. So she's kind of been my person ever since then.
Now, of course, a lot of us go see our high school guidance counselors. What do you think made this meeting different?
I think it was how determined I was. And my mom even says that. She says since I was a small girl, I always made up my mind very early, and then I kind of really stuck with that path. And I guess she said I was so adamant about it that she's like, all right, well, let me see what I can do to assist you in becoming the successful person that you have in your mind. And so from then, I guess she just kind of saw my perseverance, even when things got hard, and just kind of kept sticking by my side as different situations would come up, and has been there all the time, even to this day, which is really huge to have that type of mentorship that lasts into your adult life.
What kinds of challenges were you facing in high school where you needed someone to really give you a hand?
Well, you know, like many people, I came up in a situation where poverty was a huge issue, and my mom was a single mom at that time, and with, you know, we didn't have all the resources. My mom, she didn't have the educational background to be able to do advanced work, which is really a challenge in a community like in here in Johnson County, because so many people have so many degrees. And so she was doing the best that she could. And so I came to a point when I was a senior that I ended up dealing with some homelessness. And so then I didn't have anyone at that time necessarily that I can really depend on. And she was one of the few people in my school that knew about the situation and some of the issues that came from that. And so she just really had saw me persevere from 15 to 17. And when I hit that mark at 17 of homelessness, she really kind of just stood in that corner and tried to make things a little easier for me to transition, because I was doing well in school, but I was starting to have some struggles because I didn't have that consistency. And so, you know, when it came to a time when I wanted to get a scholarship, I made it to the finals and came that I needed to be in Des Moines, and I had no one who would give me a ride to a scholarship appointment. And so I just so happened to find her number in the phone book back when we used phone books. And I called her and I said, I don't know if it's right to call you, but I'm in this situation and I really want to go to this scholarship interview in Des Moines. And she's like, well, I'll drive you. Wow. And she said it just so happened to work out that she was there. And she took me down to an interview for Principal Financial Group. And that was at one time they were giving away, not giving away, obviously you have to earn, but scholarships for 4 years. So I ended up going out to that interview. And because of her driving me there and my interview, I had a 4-year scholarship to get through the University of Iowa. So huge when someone just kind of stands in your corner. And then from there, you know, even from going to graduate school and her looking out for me even then and being able to connect me with other funding opportunities, other scholarships, working with PEO women, et cetera, here in our community, to leaving there and going on and getting married. And, you know, she helped me pay for my dress and came to my dress fitting for when I bought the dress and, you know, made my kids blankets when I had twins and, wow. You know, was at my wedding. Her and her husband have been phenomenal in my life. And her husband is more like a father, and she's a mother to me, who I love dearly, like my own mother, you know, because I, you know, when someone goes through that many milestones in your life, from getting married to having children to, you know, graduating from undergrad and college, you that's your family. And I don't see her any differently than I would my own mother. Because when my mother wasn't able to mother me in the way that she wanted to, she stepped in and she filled that void. And it had nothing to do with race. It was about love. And it made such a huge difference in my life. And it's just one of those things I try to encourage people to push past all our different biases and different things. You never know how you might impact someone's life, how you might change their entire life in a simple act of kindness. Now, a drive to a scholarship, you know.
Right. When you walked into her office, she was struck by your determination. But when did you realize this woman is different from the other adults in my life? This woman will go the extra mile for me.
I think it was when I hit that bout in high school where I went through homelessness. There was some different situations and I didn't realize how much she had intervened on my behalf until later, you know, whether it was she made sure that I had a safe place to sleep that night. And she made sure that when people might have been joking and things in high school, but when you're in a trauma situation, she prepared my teachers to go. She may not react in the ways that she normally would react. Even when I got my first apartment, she came and she brought some blankets and things because I had no furniture, you know, so even that same weekend, I had to go and take my ACTs after finding myself in a homeless situation, and she made sure I got to them. She's like, you can retake this, and I'm like, I'm just going to do the best I can. I'm exhausted emotionally, and I still graduated. She made sure I had a prom dress and prom shoes. She made sure that I had senior pictures, though my family wasn't able to do that. Wow. So I think that's when it solidified in my life that, you know, this is someone who is a caring and supportive adult in my life that's not looking for or for anything from me. She didn't want anything from me except for me to be the successful person that I told her that I would be when I walked in her office. And now at this point, her and my mother have a really good relationship as well. And so we all care. Like, they care about my family. I care about their family because we're all family.
You are a social worker now and on the school board.
Mm-hmm.
Was that career path partly inspired by Pat and the work that she did as a counselor?
I think so. I think that was the thing that inspired me to want to give back in a big way. She knows a lot of the current work that I do in the community as a social worker. And one significant program was to uplift the voices of young women of color. And so in the school district, we have a lot of programming. And so I've talked to her a lot about that. And when I decided I wanted to run for school board, she's like, well, you just never cease to amaze me. You're doing everything. Every time I look up, you're in the newspaper. And a lot of it is my energy towards trying to impact the lives of young women and girls, because someone did that for me. Someone was my, you know, she's my Pat. I want to be a Pat to someone else. And so I just have extended myself and tried to find other opportunities for other people to connect with young women so that they can all have these amazing stories to tell about that caring, supportive adult. So she's inspired me a lot by that.
And shown you the power of one caring adult, what someone can do.
It's amazing.
Latasha, thank you so much for sharing your story today.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for the call and for this opportunity.
Latasha DeLoach is a social worker in Johnson County and a member of the Iowa City School Board. And we weren't able to interview all of the people who shared their stories of kindness, so I want to share a few more with you right now. We heard from Annie Ventulo. She's a school-based therapist from the Iowa City area. She works in a rural district, and she wrote, "As a school-based child and family therapist, I specialize in trauma-informed practice, so I experience a fair amount of heavy emotional subject matter. Sometimes it can be quite intense. When I was approached by the school social worker informing me of a child's letter to Santa requesting a bed, my heart sank. Yet another sad story, I thought. Upon further investigation, we discovered that while his parents worked very hard to provide for him and his siblings' needs, a bed was not a possibility at this time. Two other children in the area also had similar requests for Santa. Knowing there was no program in their county to assist with something like this, I posted a message on Facebook just to see what I could find. Within hours, I had a huge outpouring of support from community members and had three beds lined up, as well as donated funds to purchase every child in each home a new bed and comforter set. Hearing these tough stories of all sorts of childhood traumas and feeling helpless in the face of many of these children's experiences, this amazingly positive community support had me weeping with joy. The people donating included a photographer, a nonprofit executive director, an art store clerk, a nurse, a college professor, a barista, and a delivery driver. Everyday people from all walks of life with nothing in common but a desire to help another. People wanting to help out families they'd never met, not knowing their stories or backgrounds, but simply helping for the sake of supporting their fellow human beings. It reminded me that in spite of the tough stuff we hear on the news and the negative interactions we may have at times, humanity truly is good. This experience reinforced in me the continued desire to simply be good to one another. I also received this reminder that kindness doesn't just come from our fellow humans. This is from Mel Henry, and she has struggled with a long and difficult illness. She writes, "As grateful as I am for my doctor, the best care I've gotten has been from my cat. That may sound silly and trivial to most people, but she's been more therapeutic to me than any medicine I've taken. She's as gifted as any service animal and more intuitive than most people I know. Every day she snuggles next to me wherever I am in the house. She doesn't let our more energetic pets get too close. When there's a lot of noise or chaos, and there always is with teenaged kids in the house, she herds me to my bedroom and stays with me until my nerves return to normal. She's in tune with my moods. She sleeps when I sleep, eats when I eat, and is playful when I need her to be playful. She's been part of our lives for 8 years and will be for years to come. She's my peace and my happy place. Shadow is quite literally my best friend, although she's more like a furry little angel. I don't know what I'd do without her." Thank you so much to everyone who shared their stories of kindness with me. I wish that we had time to share all of them. We do have two more stories of remarkable acts of kindness coming up next on Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're sharing stories of kindness. And this next story is a story of cross-cultural and cross-species kindness and cooperation. Jill Preetz is a primatologist. She's the Walvoord Professor of Liberal Arts and Sciences, specializing in biological anthropology at Iowa State University. And for the last 14 years, she's been studying the lives of savanna chimpanzees in Senegal, dividing her time between the field and her work in Ames, and she is with us on the phone today. Hello, Jill.
Hi.
Well, thank you so much for being here today. And when I asked you for a story about kindness, you immediately thought of a really intense experience that you had involving several different chimpanzees, but in particular one named Amy. Tell us what happened.
Well, this was 2009, and I had just visited Senegal for just a few weeks over our, our holiday break. And I got back, and I got a phone call from my project manager, Dondo Conte, and he said that someone had approached him about a chimpanzee because they heard that he did something with chimps, and they had a baby. And he, right away, realized it was probably from our group. And so he called me and I said, we need to get the infant back.
And so this was someone who was trying to sell the chimpanzee or?
I think they were. I think they probably were thinking about selling her. And so it was really lucky that they, you know, approached him and that then he somehow got the baby from them. without, you know, kind of alerting them to the fact that they were going to be in big trouble. And I basically flew back within the next 48 hours. And, you know, I arrived at his house at midnight. You know, I took a bush taxi. It took me hours and hours and hours. And we went out with the baby the next morning and found the miraculously. I mean, there was just like a series, I say, of miracles. Not a very scientific word, but it was just, you know, I still can't believe that we were so lucky because we found the group with the mom and then were able to then think about putting the baby back.
So why, I know that in your work, it's important for you to maintain a certain amount of distance from the chimpanzees that you're studying. And I know that you were incredibly distressed to find out that one of the chimps had been basically kidnapped, but why was it so important for you to try to return that infant to her mother, given that you kind of had to cross a lot of boundaries that you had set for yourself?
Right. Well, I mean, on one level, it was really personal, and it's always interesting because, you know, I know how I feel about the chimps, and I'm, you know, I, of course, try to be as scientifically objective as humanly possible. But, you know, there's some time, there's some, at some points, you know, I make decisions and they may not be, you know, as scientific as other people might judge or something along those lines. But I think with great apes, we've changed the way we've thought about how we, you know, I guess I manage wild populations, if you can say that. But, you know, in this case, I had no doubts that, you know, we needed to intervene. And the thought of, you know, Amy living in a zoo or something like that, when there was a possibility she could be returned her mother, I mean, that was just not an option. And it was, it had been 5 days since she was taken. And so it was a very brief period of time. But as it was, I couldn't find any cases of this occurring with chimpanzees. There were similar cases in gorillas where they were able to return the infant gorilla, but not in chimps.
And so you had no idea if this was even going to work.
Right. Well, I mean, I guess I was pretty sure that they would take the baby back. I knew that for sure. I think Dondo and Michelle were less certain of that, but I had no doubt. It was such a short period of time since she was absent that they would take her back. But I guess what I wasn't sure of is how they would react to us because we had the baby. So that was a big question. That's why I really felt I needed to be there and I didn't want to put, you know, the guys that work for me at risk, because we thought, well, maybe the males would be very aggressive because, you know, here we are with an infant.
Right.
So that was a big question.
Right. They might think that you were the danger. So how,
right.
How did you reintroduce Amy? What did you do?
Well, 9 months, they don't really walk. And we were hoping that she would at least vocalize. So I carried her and, you know, we all wore surgical masks and gloves and things like that. And we really tried to protect her from being contaminated by, you know, humans, even though she was taken by people and, you know, was exposed to germs, et cetera. But I did carry her out there. The chimps were a couple of kilometers from camp. And then when we got close, we put her into a bag and we were going to put her on the ground and then let the chimps find her. So we were trying to judge where they were moving. And so we all three went together and we still had Amy in a sack. And then we set her within like 20 meters of where the chimps were feeding in a ficus and then, you know, moved back. And what was really amazing was that an adolescent male, Mike, who's always very curious and always really attentive to us. I think he saw us put Amy down. I think he was the first one. And he was there in an instant, and he picked Amy up and then basically just beelined it for the tree where her mother was and essentially handed her off to her mother.
Wow.
So that was pretty amazing. And I saw the handoff, and everyone, all the chimps gathered around the baby, and you could hear her giving little tiny pant grunts. So we actually filmed much of this. And I stayed with a group just to see, you know, how things were going. And then that day, that evening, when the chimps go on their kind of long travel, they usually travel a couple kilometers to their next nesting site. Tia couldn't keep up because, like I said, she had been injured, and she had been injured by the hunter's dogs, it turned out. And so she would stop and put Amy down and rest. An adult male hung back with her, and he would, you know, wait with her. But then eventually Mike came back, and he picked up the baby, and he carried Amy for Tia for the rest of the travel. And that was pretty amazing as well, because adolescent males, you know, I mean, they'll be interested in infants. But the fact that Mike so obviously, you know, was helping Tia when she was having trouble keeping up, I mean, that was just amazing. And he did the same thing the next day. So in the morning, Tia could keep up, but in the afternoon, she was fatigued and she couldn't keep up, and Mike carried the baby for her again. And so, I mean, the whole scenario was just an amazing stroke of luck or miracle or whatever you want to call it. But
and behavior was, that you can really only interpret as compassion on
Mike's
part.
Right. Yeah. And I actually wrote up a note in the Journal of Ethology about, you know, is Mike's behavior is an example of empathy. And, you know, I mean, your knee jerk reaction is, yeah, this is exactly what it is. But then if you, you know, look at it scientifically, he satisfied all the requirements that we use to, you know, judge whether an animal or a human or anything has empathy. And so that was just, I mean, yeah, that was amazing. So Mike always, you know, everyone has a soft spot for Mike, I think, after that. And yeah, he's an interesting guy.
So this isn't the end of Tia's story.
No. Yeah, Tia, I don't know. I don't know what to say about Tia. She was just an unlucky chimp. But several years later, in fact, 4 years later, I was in the U.S. and my mother was actually ill. And so I left Senegal, and I got a call from my project manager, Dondo, and my PhD student at the time. She's now doctor, but she was at the time still in our program, Stacy Linshield. She was there working on her research, and Michelle was also there. And they actually found Tia, and she had died of a snake bite, apparently. And at this point, Tia, 2 months earlier, had given birth to her second infant, Toto. And Toto was there with Tia, and Amy was also there. And so Amy was weaned. She was about 4 years old. And Toto would cry periodically because an infant of that age would nurse, you know, maybe hourly. And whenever he would cry, Amy would come over and she would groom Toto. And they asked me what to do, and I said, well, wait and see if any other chimps find Toto and Amy. And in all likelihood, even if someone would have found her, all of the females had their own infants, and someone would have probably carried Toto, but he would have likely died. Mm-hmm. But no one did find him. And so I made the decision that they should take Toto. And so late in the afternoon, they finally went and picked up Toto and gave him a bottle. He was very dehydrated. He would have died that night if something wouldn't have gotten him, like a hyena. He would have died, you know, soon after of you know, just exposure and dehydration. And so they picked up Toto, and he was used to us, even though he was 2 months old. We were part of his environment. And so he was, of course, stressed by the death of his mother and the fact that, you know, she wasn't responding to him. But he was relatively unstressed when they retrieved him, and then they took care of him. And we've been taking care of Toto ever since. And now we're looking for a place for him to spend the rest of his years.
How old is Toto now?
Toto is now a little over 3 years. So he was 3 in August.
And because he is so accustomed to humans and was raised by humans, he can't be reintegrated into that group?
Well, I think that we had plans. That was our hope, that he could be reintegrated. And he definitely is used to humans. I think, though, we would have still tried to integrate him. But there have been some significant changes in Senegal. And so it's basically a gold rush. And there are a lot of people in the area, And many of the people that have come into this area of Senegal are from other countries, and they don't have the same taboos against eating chimps that people in Senegal do. So even though, for example, Amy was taken, they didn't kill Tio, which was miraculous in itself. And, you know, we're trying to sell Amy for a pet, but people don't eat chimps in Senegal. Some of the people that have moved into the country because of the gold rush do. And so we're worried about Toto's lack of fear, even though his group, the Fongoli chimps, still do have what I call a healthy fear of humans other than us. So that was one concern, and the fact that he might not only put himself at danger, but endanger the chimpanzee group. And that was who we have to put first, is the larger group of chimps and the population of chimps in Senegal. So that was one reason we decided he couldn't go back. And then the other reason was that Toto is a very healthy young chimp, and even though he's 3 years old and technically a baby, he is as large as a six-year-old. So the chimps would not regard him as an infant anymore, and that could be very dangerous, especially for a male. So he's the size of a juvenile and even a young adolescent male. And so he expects to be carried, for example. He weighs 50 pounds, and he's just sort of like a giant baby. And so that also, you know, it's great for him on one level because he's very healthy, but he's a little too big to be considered an infant. So it's unlikely that they would treat him like an infant. They would probably be aggressive towards him. At least some of the males would be.
What happened to Amy?
Oh, that's a very, it's a sad story, I think. We don't know for sure, but Amy, about 4 months after her mom died, there was an estrus female, and all of the males were very interested in this estrus female.
That's a female in heat.
Yes, basically a female in heat. And so the males are very interested in her, and there's usually a lot of aggression associated with that. And so Amy left with a female and her offspring, who's about Amy's age, and actually one male left with them. And so they were gone for about 10 days, and we stayed with the group, you know, our study subjects were the males in this other group. And when that little group of chimps came back, Amy wasn't with them. I kind of wonder if she was taken by a predator. Like I said, she was, you know, she would kind of lag behind. There are not a lot of predators at Fongoli, but I have some camera trap images of a leopard, and there are hyenas around as well. And so I you know, she was healthy when we last saw her, but, you know, she never returned. And we held out hope for a long time, thinking maybe she got lost. I don't really think that was probably the case. But so Amy never came back. But I guess one thing that I like to think about that is that she was able to spend almost 4 years of her life with her group instead of being a captive. And you know, if she hadn't been rescued and sent to a zoo, she probably would have died. I mean, the people were trying to feed her bananas. She didn't know what a banana was, and she was afraid of them, so she wouldn't eat. And so I like to try to focus on those 3 years that Amy had and her group. And I was glad that she was able to you know, spend the last years of her life with her group. So that's what I try to focus on.
Jill, I understand that you watch the chimpanzees as a scientist and learn what you can from their behavior and their culture, as you've reported in many papers. But just as a person watching these interactions, seeing these compassionate acts of Mike and developing a personal relationship with Toto, what do you take away from this experience that you can share with the rest of us?
Oh, gosh, that's a hard question. I might get a little emotional. I really see them as individuals. And I think, I mean, I consider myself lucky because they're so similar to us, and they're very different from us as well. But to me, it's so amazing that they're animals on this planet that are so similar to us, and that you can see things like compassion and personality. And I just feel like I'm one of the luckiest people because I get to see that. My field assistant, Michelle, I mean, he tells me that if he is not with the chimps for several days, he starts to dream about them because they are like his family. And so I mean, I think it's amazing. It can be very difficult. I had a very difficult time when one of my very favorite chimps died when he was fairly young. So it is, you know, it is difficult, but I know, I think it's one of the luckiest jobs in the world as well. And I really wish that other people could have the same experience I do, in part just to have insight into, you know, great apes, not only cognitive abilities, but emotional abilities. That to me is always probably the most striking, is their emotional similarities. So that's, you know, why I via social media and film and things like that, I like to share the Fongoli chimps, because I might be a little biased, but I think they're pretty great.
Jill, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Oh, thank you. You know, I love to talk about the chimps, and I guess the last thing I had said that, you know, the fact that we were able to put Amy back was probably one of the major accomplishments of that year, for our project, and probably it's one of the best feelings I've ever had in my life as well, as being able to do that.
Jill Preetz is a primatologist and an anthropologist. She studies chimpanzees in Senegal and teaches at Iowa State University. We'll hear another story of an act of kindness next on Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're taking some time to celebrate acts of kindness. And Angie Hansen, a mother of five who lives in Mason City, has been on the receiving end of many acts of kindness over the past 2 years. It's a position she never wanted to be in. But she is with me today. Hello, Angie.
Hi, Charity. Nice to hear from you.
Yeah, thank you so much for talking with me today. And I want to go back to the beginning of this story. This is a journey that really started for you in March of 2014. Tell me what happened.
Yeah, so just living my life like normal, healthy, running five kids here and there. I'm a stay-home mom. And because a friend was diagnosed with breast cancer, I took it upon myself to take myself in to get what I thought was just going to be a cyst checked. And come to find out that they found that it was cancer. Called my husband in, and it just totally shocked our family. Not only was it breast cancer, it was stage 3C, which is just, for people who don't know, just a half stage above being metastatic. And it was a very serious cancer, and it just shocked us.
And as you alluded to, you are a very strong, active woman, five children, but also a marathon runner, and really the last person anybody would have expected this to happen to.
Right. I can't tell you how many people said that to me. I cannot believe that you have breast cancer.
And I can't even begin to imagine, as a mother of five children, at that point, getting that diagnosis, what were you thinking about?
Right away, just thinking of the kids, of course. I mean, that's the first thing you think through, is I want to be here for them. I mean, I feel that God has put me on this earth to raise those five kids. They're young. They were at the time 2, 5, 7, 9, and 11. I wasn't ready to think about the end of my life by any means, but all of us, when you hear the word cancer, you start to feel or fear the worst. And so I was just thinking about them and how I would do anything to be here for them. Absolutely.
Now, of course, you immediately made plans to do whatever you could to pursue treatment and fight this cancer. You have a very strong community with your church, with your neighborhood. And I think even you, though, were surprised by how people responded. Can you tell me a little bit about what began to happen as you shared what was going on with you?
Yes, it was. This is where the act of kindness comes in. I mean, it was unbelievable. The people would just show up. They just kept showing up with things at our home. We had meal trains scheduled where I didn't make meals for weeks and weeks, and to make a meal for seven people is no small task. Believe me, I know. I do it all the time. People were just overflowing with kindness. But the one that blew me away in my particular treatment, I had to do chemotherapy first to shrink the tumor because it was 10 centimeters. And so I didn't get to do surgery first like some people do. So they wanted me to start right with chemotherapy. And it wasn't even, I think it was maybe within 2 weeks of finding out, I was ready for my first dose of chemotherapy. And my treatment was at 7:30, scheduled for 7:30 in the morning. And we woke up that morning like usual. The only thing that was strange was my kids were putting on their shoes already, and I was like, what's going on? But we were heading out the door, my husband and I. They said goodbye, and then they came running behind me because as I walked out the door, I saw people lining the street, our entire neighborhood of people, community of people, friends, with signs of encouragement saying, you know, run the race, you've got this, you know, all these wonderful sayings and cheering like I was in a race, which as a runner was just so, so inspiring, and just, of course, brought both my husband and I to tears. It was a huge showing of love and support at 7:30 in the morning. Wow. On a Tuesday or something like that. So, yes, as we drove by, they all were squealing, and I even had a couple friends on vacation in Ireland, and they had FaceTimed in, and I got to talk to them for a second, and it just was an incredible showing of love and support from this community and just from all the friends and acquaintances we have here in town. And it just put me on a really good start for treatment because when I got there, the love that I felt from the people was with me.
I can imagine that that really helped your kids too.
It sure did. There were tons of kids out there and their friends, so they went running to them and were giving hugs, and it was cool. Some of the kids even made signs, and what was cool about those signs was that we then brought all those signs home and lined the inside of the garage with those signs during the entire journey of treatment, which took nearly a year and a half to finish everything. They lined the back of the garage wall, so every time we would pull in, we would see those signs of encouragement from all those people.
That's so cool.
Yeah.
Now, over that year and a half, what was the course of treatment? You started with chemo.
Started with chemotherapy. So that started in April. It finished in July. So I did 16 weeks of treatment. I had adriamycin, which is a really strong drug that made me very, very sick and, of course, lose my hair. And then after I finished the chemotherapy, then I had to wait a little bit before I was allowed to have surgery. I think it was about 4 weeks. And then I had a bilateral mastectomy at that time. Then I think I had to wait again another 4 weeks before I started my radiation treatment. And then after that was complete, I needed to wait 6 months till I could finish my final reconstruction. At the end of radiation, and I suppose that was in November-ish, that's when I was really done with the main treatments. But it was definitely a long haul, much longer than I would have imagined when I started.
Absolutely. Now, I followed your journey on Facebook. We were high school classmates, I guess.
Yes.
Classmates all the way through from elementary to high school.
Yes, we were.
And so from afar, I watched. And one of the things that really struck me with the things that you shared is that you and your community found so many opportunities during this time for celebrations. When you were losing your hair,
that was a fun one.
Well, tell us about it.
We had, when I needed to shave my head, I didn't really personally want to wait for it to fall out. I wanted to kind of take charge of that. So people who know me well know that I like to have parties. So I was all in for a party to shave my head. I wanted my kids to witness it being something of strength and happiness instead of sadness. And so we invited a ton of friends over, girlfriends, lots of them, and my mother and my mother-in-law and all sorts of people were over. And I think we called it making lemonade out of lemons or something like that. And we had everyone outside. It was a beautiful night in April. And my hairdresser came over and shaved my head while everyone cheered. I had people on FaceTiming in from out of town, and it was it was more of an event than sadness, for sure.
I've also seen that you have taken this same approach to other women who are going through their cancer journeys now.
Right. It has really brought me closer to understanding what people are going through, and it's brought me closer to so many wonderful women that I've met through this journey who have endured many of the same things that I have. I just have a better understanding for what they've gone through and how to help support them. I hope that they feel that from me because I care very deeply for them and what they're dealing with. I have friends who are fighting right now different types of cancer.
What is your health status now?
Remission. You know, the stats don't look very good in my favor as far as recurrence rate or 5-year survival rate or all these numbers. And I just have to remind myself that I have faith that I'm going to make it. I'm here for my kids. I want to be here for my husband. I want to have a big, long, healthy life. But I also a realist to know that chances are very high of this recurring and for it to be metastatic at that point and for things not to look good for me. But I live every day to the fullest. I take my supplements. I exercise. I, you know, try and keep an alkaline body and all those important things. But more than that, I pray that I will be able to kick cancer once and for all this time.
You talked about final reconstruction. And so having gotten through surgery and through reconstructive surgery, you took a trip not that long ago with a friend that you've had forever, a friend from your earliest childhood days. Tell me about this trip that you took.
That's right. It was something I'd looked forward to since the very beginning. So early in treatment, I want to say chemotherapy, I had come across a video on Facebook or maybe it was YouTube, I don't even remember, of a specialist in 3D areola or nipple tattooing who has people fly in from all over the world to see him at this shop called Little Vinny's. It's in Finksburg, Maryland. And I was showing my best friend from growing up. She had traveled all the way here from Iowa City to be with me on one of my chemotherapies. And she said, "You need to do that." And I said, "You know, I feel like I do." And then nothing was really said about that because it was so long. The journey was another year and a half almost from then.
Well, and for people who don't understand, so when you had the mastectomy and you know, you went through reconstructive surgery,
right?
You had breasts.
I did.
But they look different than they used to.
Right, absolutely. So, yeah, let me explain that. So what they do is they put in what they call expanders. And expanders hold the place of where your breasts used to be. And they can inflate those over time to be a little bit bigger or whatever size you can be at that time. Now, they take a lot of skin and they take the whole nipple. Not for everyone, but in my case, they between the doctors and myself, we decided to take everything just to be safe and to make sure we get everything. And when they sew you back together, there's scars going kind of diagonally across both breasts, but there's no nipple. And so at the reconstruction, then they take the expanders out and they replace them with an implant, which is then your final reconstruction, but you still don't have nipples at that time. And so 6 months after your final reconstruction, or I think maybe it was 5 months, they allow you to do the tattooing if you choose.
And so why was it important to you to do that? Why? I mean,
right, obviously.
I mean, some women pursue that. Many women don't. It's a fairly specialized thing.
It is. And Charity, I went through all sorts of thoughts through the whole thing. There was a time when I thought I wouldn't reconstruct at all. There was a time when I thought, you know, there was definitely ups and downs through this whole thing. But I kept going back to that first time that I saw that video and I saw this woman going through the procedure and I saw how she felt and she shared how she just felt like herself again and she felt complete. And that was huge for me. I just decided that I wanted to do that. And it definitely was something I wanted to do with this best friend of mine.
And so she was the one that, did she point you toward the video in the first place, or was that?
No, I had seen it and I showed her. She would just happen to be over here spending the night and going to chemo with me. And I said, look at this. She's like, you need to do that. And then, like I said, nothing really had been said. That was probably June, and it was another, it was a long ways away, a year and 4 months or so away. This last November was when I finished, just a month ago.
That's quite an amazing friendship to span all those years. And then, hey, I want to have 3D nipples tattooed.
I know.
Will you come with me?
I know.
So what was that trip like?
It was absolutely a celebration and just enjoying each other. We haven't really spent time traveling together, and I think we need to do it a lot more often. I said, this needs to maybe be yearly, maybe not the tattoo part, but the rest. Just spending time with her and just enjoying life and just, you know, both of us are busy moms, just getting away for a long weekend. And she's a teacher, so, you know, it was wonderful that she was able to take those days off during the year. So that she took a Friday and a Monday so that we could spend the weekend together.
And having gone through the process of the tattooing process, how does that change how you feel about yourself?
When I finished radiation, people were excited. When I finished chemotherapy, people were excited. When I finished all these things, people were excited for me. But I never really felt done, ever, you know? And this last trip and this last final piece, if you will, and the tattoo artist said this too, you know, it's really the end of a really long journey for people. It's a really emotional step, and I was afraid I was just going to be an emotional mess, and I wasn't. It was more just like, yay, I'm done, and it didn't hurt at all, which I was afraid. I mean, maybe a little, but not, I don't have a lot of feeling in that area, so it was just more of a unique experience, and I was so happy to be able to share it with Sarah.
Having gone through this journey and had so many friends step forward to help you and your kids and your husband in so many ways, and to have Sarah take time out of her life to go with you on that final step on the journey, how does that change you to have received all of these acts of kindness?
It changes you in so many ways. You're just more aware of people who are in need. You know how to step in and help them. And one thing I've learned through all of this is you should tell the person what you're going to do, not just say, let me know if you need anything. I can, you know, people aren't going to say, yeah, I need you to make me a meal or whatever. It's better to say, hey, I'm going to pick up your kids on Tuesday and bring them over to my house for a few hours. It's a lot easier to accept help when it's specific. And so I guess that's what I've learned the most, is to be more specific with the help that I give people.
Do you feel like it's made you a more giving person too?
Absolutely. I don't know how it couldn't. I mean, to see all these people who are, you know, giving of themselves in so many ways. I mean, we had people cleaning out our garage one weekend. We had people who were in our home organizing things. I can't even tell you how many people and how acts of kindness I could go on all day.
Angie, thank you so much for sharing your story with us today.
You're welcome. So happy to.
Angie Hansen is a mother of five who lives in Mason City. All this hour, we've been taking some time to reflect on the power of kindness. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Happy holidays.